Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America imports more and more oil and exports more and more military power to secure global oil supplies. The cost of that protection is rising. Tonight on Point, oil and the military. How U.S. dependence on foreign oil is driving American military policy. We begin tonight in Iraq. The weekend saw multiple insurgent bombings, a U.S. death toll now topping 1,100, and artillery fire and airstrikes around Fallujah as U.S. Marines tightened their ring around the city, setting the stage for another attempt to take control there. And U.S. officials have spoken out on the Army Reserve Unit that last week refused to man a fuel convoy they called a suicide mission. Ashraf Khalil is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. I asked him for the latest on the reluctant reserve unit.
Well, with the Army Reserve Unit, that's probably the newest thing, is that yesterday, Brigadier General here, who was in command of the overall corps, the supply unit that these soldiers who refused to run this mission were part of, the military held the somewhat unusual step of scheduling a press conference to get their side of the story out. So that's obvious that they're taking this very seriously. And actually, the general's comments sounded somewhat sympathetic to these soldiers. He very pretty much acknowledged that they were driving in unsafe trucks and said they're back on duty and said that their disciplinary fate is still uncertain. But, you know, it sounded like an acknowledgement that, yeah, okay, these guys had a legit concern and we're working on it.
18 reservists, a 7-tanker fuel convoy was supposed to be north of Baghdad last Wednesday. They were concerned about the lack of armor and the questionable maintenance. And you're saying that Brigadier General James Chambers is essentially, at some level, backing them up.
To an extent. They're still making it clear that these soldiers could face disciplinary action because they did disobey orders. They did refuse orders, and they're taking that very seriously. But he basically said, yeah, not all of our trucks are armored, and this is more dangerous work than they're normally doing. They normally drive safer routes, and this was one of the first times that they've been asked to drive this particular route between two bases north of Baghdad. So he said they were on a dangerous mission and pretty much acknowledged they weren't properly equipped.
We see General Chambers saying that driving a truck in Iraq is among the most dangerous jobs in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it came off sympathetic to me from what I read. He said they're back on duty, which means something. If it was a serious disciplinary issue, they probably wouldn't be back on duty. He said that the entire unit is standing down for 2 weeks to properly armor and maintain their vehicles to fix the problem. He basically acknowledged the problem, and that means something in their defense.
Is there concern about more of this kind of refusal to serve? Has there been much of it before? Is this the first time it's been an issue?
It's certainly the first time I've seen it on this large a scale. Certainly there's individual disciplinary problems in any army in any situation, but yeah, this kind of unit-wide, no. No, you had it with Iraqi security forces a couple of times this year of units refusing to serve, refusing to shoot at other Iraqis. But no, this is larger than anything else that I've seen.
And what about security over the last couple of days in and around Baghdad, Ashraf? How's it been?
It's been pretty tense. You know, from among the foreign community, the journalistic community, it's becoming very bunkered down. There's a definite sense of siege throughout the city. And I'm not saying that the foreigners are unique in this. The foreigners are pretty much absolutely sharing this with the Iraqi people.
Ashraf, let me just ask you, have you kept up at all with the flow of oil there? We hear occasionally about attacks on pipelines around the country. Has that been an issue in recent days?
I'm not sure about recent days. I know that in general it's gone up and down, and I know that Iraq's target oil export is well down overall for the year. There have been a number of shutdowns. It's gotten bad enough that we're not even talking about oil exports. I mean, there have been times when power plants or lines have been cut, or lines have been cut that feed power plants, which result in widespread blackouts. You know, at times, we're not even at the point of exporting. It's just we're failing to supply.
How about the Iraqi government? What's their message over the weekend?
The Iraqi government has been focused on two things mainly, which is Fallujah and the weapons transfer in Sadr City. I mean, sort of the parallel peace initiatives in both cases to stomp out in varying levels parallel insurgencies that are taking place. Prime Minister Alawi yesterday paid a visit to Sadr City for the last day of this week-long weapons transfer that's supposed to kick off the peace agreement they have with Muqtada Sadr and end the fighting with the Maqi army. The government sounds reasonably pleased with the result. The U.S. military has consistently said all week that they were unhappy with the numbers, that it wasn't an appropriate percentage, that it wasn't nearly enough, considering a small percentage of the weapons they know to be hidden in Sadr City. So now that the weapons transfer is over and can be assessed, there's a chance that the fighting will resume, that the U.S. and the Iraqi forces will sweep through and look for these weapons and will be back to the nightly battlegrounds in Sadr City. In Fallujah, it appears to be further down towards violent possibilities, and the political approach appears to have completely broken down. Negotiations have ended. The chief negotiator for the city of Fallujah was arrested on Friday and released today, but it's not going well. It's more a question of when will the military push begin in Fallujah.
And now Iraqis head into the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, which last year was a violent month.
Yeah, there was a lot of tension this year because of the example of last year. Last year, the first week in particular was very bad. There were 4 car bombings on police stations and on the local headquarters of the Red Cross on the first day of Ramadan.
Ashraf Khalil, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Ashraf Khalil is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Baghdad. It is no secret that oil drives the American economy. Until the 1990s, most of that oil came from American wells. Now, with the share of imported oil surging every year and growing competition from other countries at the global spigot, the days of running the American engine on the cheap are passing, but there is more than oil prices in play. Securing the global oil supply is a major foreign policy consideration, maybe the major consideration. A new book argues that U.S. armed forces have been reduced to a global petroleum security service, and that included in the price of every drop of oil now is the price of U.S. blood shed to secure it. This hour, On Point Oil and the American Military. Is the U.S. military becoming a global oil field protection service? Does importing more oil necessarily mean exporting more military power? Is there an alternative to posting American soldiers over global oil wells, pipelines, and tanker routes? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Northampton, Massachusetts, is Michael Clare, director of the 5-College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He is author of the new book, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency. Good evening and welcome, Michael Clare.
I'm happy to join you.
It's wonderful to have you. You're making a pretty tough case in this book. You say that essentially, with every additional barrel of imported oil that the United States brings into the country, we're having to export more U.S. troops to make that possible, to make that secure, if I got the formula right.
That's right.
And is there an end to this? Where are we headed with this trend?
It could only get worse. And the reason for that is that the global center of gravity of oil production is shifting. At one time, most of the world's oil was produced in relatively stable countries of the industrialized world, especially the United States and Canada and Europe. But increasingly in the future, oil is going to come from the developing world and especially from the most unstable areas of the developing world, the Middle East, Africa, the Andean region of Latin America, and Central Asia, because that's where the world's remaining oil is located. So there's an ever-increasing risk of encountering instability, terrorism, and violence in the areas that we depend for our oil. And I fear, under present policy, that means more U.S. troops being sent to protect it.
And you describe that, Michael Clare, as a trap for the United States and for its military. Others might describe it as a necessity to go out and get that oil to keep the wheels of industry and commerce and moving and just keep the house warm. Trap or necessity?
Well, you know, this is as much a moral question as anything else, and I think it's up for each individual American to answer that for himself or herself. But I think it's unethical to risk the lives of young men and women in uniform so that people can drive very fuel-inefficient vehicles to waste oil. In our country, a lot of the oil we use is wasted. It's wasted in very inefficient vehicles. We could switch to more efficient vehicles and more efficient energy use, and we wouldn't need all of this imported oil.
But you're saying it's a trap in what sense?
Well, it's a trap because the acquisition of foreign oil from these areas invites opposition. That is, the more we become dependent on the Middle East, the more we become dependent on Africa, most of these countries are ruled by elites that are, you know, in bed with the oil companies, and they arouse the opposition of the masses of the country, the ordinary people who do not see the benefits of the oil wealth. So wherever we go, we're linked to the Saudi royal family, dictators in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, military leaders in Nigeria, producing resistance from the rest of the population, which is directed at us. So we become the targets of the wrath of the citizens who feel discriminated against and abused by the governments we support.
And in many cases, you're saying literally targets. I want to come back. We'll get to what you're suggesting to address this. But I wish you'd give us the short course on, as you see it, on the history of what you describe as the securitizing of this one particular resource, oil. It wasn't always this way. The United States itself was an enormous producer of petroleum. How did we get into the business of U.S. troops being kind of the advance party and the guardians of oil around the world? Give us the short course.
Well, this is a very interesting history that goes back to World War II, essentially. During World War II, the United States, the world's leading oil producer, supplied almost all of the oil used by all Allied forces in the Second World War. We just provided endless amounts of oil. And Franklin Roosevelt, who was the president at the time, became very, very worried that if we kept on at this rate, the United States would run out of oil, and then we would be in deep trouble because our military and our economy rests on oil. And so he determined that the United States had to have secure foreign sources of petroleum to supplement our own production. And it was he, Roosevelt, who formed the alliance with the Saudi royal family that I think haunts us till this very day, because he promised, after his meeting with King Abdulaziz in 1945, he promised that the United States would protect the Saudi royal family indefinitely in return for access, privileged U.S. access to the oil of Saudi Arabia. And this has led to an ever-increasing U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf, and that, I believe, has led to one conflict after another. But the basic argument was that because we were becoming dependent on these foreign sources of petroleum in dangerous areas, the United States military had to assume responsibility for protecting the flow of oil. And this has remained our foreign policy and our military policy in the Persian Gulf ever since.
And when you look around the world today, Michael Clare, what's the evidence that the U.S. military is, to use your phrase, turning into a, I forget how you said, an oil security service?
Right. Well, this comes from the present predicament we're in and the work of the Bush administration in 2001, looking at our oil dilemma, concluding that the United States now, compared to Roosevelt's time, we're far more dependent on imported oil, and we need to get more and more oil from the developing world, not just the Middle East, but now Africa, Latin America, and Asia as well. And as I say, all of these areas are unstable or harbor terrorists or ethnic conflicts. And so the Bush administration, I believe, concluded that the policy we already followed in the Persian Gulf of using force to protect the flow of oil has to be extended to these other regions. And so there's a U.S. military buildup underway in the Caspian Sea region, in Africa and in Latin America.
Right around the world. Michael Clare, author of Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency. Michael, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, there's a lot more to hear, but you can join us as well tonight. What do you think? Is the U.S. military becoming a global oil field protection service? Does importing more and more oil necessarily mean exporting more and more American military power? And how high a price in troops and dollars will America pay for its last decades of global oil? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Michael Clare. He's author of the new book, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency, essentially talking about oil and the U.S. military. You can join the conversation. What does dependence on foreign oil already mean for the United States? Does it mean, for example, that the U.S. cannot leave Iraq? And is there an alternative to defending U.S. access to global oil wells, pipelines, and tanker routes? What else? How else could things operate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Clare, I wish you'd take us through some numbers here. First of all, the projections, the percentage of U.S. oil that is today imported and where that is projected to go. And then if you'd look at the costs as well, both, I guess, of the oil and also the cost of defending that oil on its way home.
Well, these are important questions for all of us. Right now, the United States imports about 55% of its total petroleum supply on an annual basis. The projections of the Department of Energy are that this will rise to about 60% by the end of this decade, and then in the next decade rise to about 65%, and then continued upward in the decades that follow. This is because America's own oil fields are in decline. Almost all of them are in decline, but our demand is rising, so we have to import more and more oil. Now, the cost of this, just for buying the oil, is going to contribute ever more substantially to the growing deficit that we have. It costs us several hundred billion dollars per year to pay for this imported oil, and with the prices rising, that price is going to go up too. And this is probably the major factor in our growing balance of payments deficit, a very significant worry for the economy.
But you say don't ignore the cost of the military deployments that are and will be required to keep that oil flowing safely.
Absolutely. And this is hard exactly to balance out, because the cost of the war in Iraq, if you think it's not about oil, then this wouldn't contribute to the total. But I believe that the war in Iraq does have a significant oil dimension. And if you add that $150 billion or so to the $50 or $100 billion we spend every year in the Persian Gulf in general, we're talking about a very substantial amount of money, let's say $200 billion a year, which would add considerably to the price of a gallon of gasoline.
Now, a lot of presidents have looked at this amount of imported oil, and you can't fail to realize that it's a national security issue. They've responded, as you say, by securitizing. Jimmy Carter, of course, very early on with that, with the Carter Doctrine. How has the Bush administration responded to the nation's growing need for imported oil?
The Bush administration has employed a little bit of smokescreen. In their energy report, the National Energy Policy, which was released on May 17, 2001, they called, among other things, for drilling for oil on Anwar, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And this produced a howl of protest because of the environmental consequences. And so most people didn't take the trouble to read the rest of the report.
Let me just ask you on that one point. If we drilled there, how much of this dependence on foreign oil would it reduce?
1 or 2%.
Okay, so it doesn't change the big picture.
It doesn't change the big picture, but it did arouse so much protest and debate that people lost track of the big picture, what you call a big picture. And what that is they project a 40 to 50% increase in U.S. dependence on the amount of oil that I should say that we will be importing from foreign suppliers over the next 25 years.
Okay.
And to accomplish that, they call for substantial American diplomatic effort and presidential effort to persuade foreign governments to supply us with more of their oil, to open up their oil industry to American investment, and to otherwise facilitate the export of oil to the United States. And this was declared to be one of the president's number one priorities.
But when you cut through that, you say that's going to boil down to a lot of military deployments in a lot of countries, or none of that's going to happen.
Oh, I think there's no question that this is going to entail increased military, is involving increased military involvement overseas. For example, the report, the Bush strategy calls for importing more oil from Africa, and there's a great deal of instability in the areas that they're interested in, especially Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea, and Angola. And so at the same time, we read that the Department of Defense is looking for military bases in Africa, and the U.S. Navy is increasing its naval presence in waters off the coast of West Africa where these countries are located.
And meanwhile, as the water hole, so to speak, shrinks, as the oil supply shrinks, there are other major economies that need it, not least new on the scene, China, in a big way.
Well, now, this is really the big geopolitical issue, I think, of the decades ahead. China is a lot like the United States in that its own domestic oil fields are in decline, but its demand is growing enormously at about twice the rate of that in the United States because so many of their rising middle-class citizens want to buy automobiles, whereas, you know, 10 years ago everybody had a bicycle, now they're buying automobiles, pushing up their demand for oil. And so they're fishing in the same troubled waters, if I could use that expression, in Africa, in Central Asia, in the Middle East. The Chinese are pursuing the same sources of oil as we are.
Not to mention Europe and Japan and a lot of other people. So we get it. The competition is rising. There's a lot more detail I want to get into with you, but let me just ask you to take it to where you go. This is where I had a little trouble following. You're saying, suggesting a pretty radical step. You're saying the United States should decouple its global military deployment from its oil needs. How does a country that consumes as much oil as the United States does and will for the foreseeable future, how on earth can it decouple those things, Michael Clare?
The only way we could do that, and you know, and I believe this is a moral prerogative, which is not to say that I don't admit that it's a difficult thing to contemplate. But we don't militarize any of our other imports, so why should we militarize this one exclusively? Well, I understand. It's important. It's very important to our economy.
We don't have to have Thai saffron or Brazilian coffee necessarily, but...
Well, there you go. Americans historically have not viewed commodities in this way. We believe in allowing market forces to prevail.
But this is oil. I mean, the place would go dark if we didn't have it.
Well, that's not true. What would happen is we'd have to be more prudent with the oil that we have. Remember, bear in mind, we still produce 45% of our oil, and we get substantial amounts from countries like Canada and Mexico that are relatively friendly. So we're not talking about turning out the lights.
I'm afraid I don't understand that. When Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait and the Saudi oil fields were threatened, the United States went over to push him back because if those oil fields were taken out somehow, the world economy would collapse.
This is true if we keep on consuming oil at the profligate rates that we do. If we and the Chinese and the Europeans and the Japanese keep on consuming oil at this level at ever increasing amounts, we will face difficulty. But the fact of the matter is that the world is going to run out of oil in another generation or so anyway. So we're going to have to learn to be more prudent in our use of this substance and use it more sparingly anyway. So I argue let's do that sooner rather than later.
So that the military butcher's bill is no higher than it has to be. But you do acknowledge that the so-called realist school of thinkers contend that we've got to go out and protect this. You quote from the Center for Strategic and International Studies that the U.S. is the world's only superpower, quote, must accept its special responsibilities for preserving access to worldwide energy supplies. You take issue with that. You say it's not a defensible position because it's going to cost so many lives, and there are alternatives, and yet a whole lot of people think that oil has to be defended. I want to turn perhaps to one of them right now. Robert Ebel joins us from McLean, Virginia. He is chairman of the Energy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was in the CIA for 11 years, the Office of Oil and Gas in the Department of Interior for 7 years, produced an assessment of Iraq's oil sector for the State Department in 2002-2003. He's author of Energy and Conflict in Central Asia and the Caucasus and Caspian Oil Windfalls. Robert Ebel, thank you for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
You hear the case being made by Michael Clare that our growing dependence on imported oil is inevitably leading to more military deployments around the world and will lead to an escalating cost in military expenditure and blood. He says, let's divorce our oil supply from our military deployments. Is that reasonable, Robert Ebel?
Well, let's look at it this way, that the number one oil supplier to the United States is Canada. We don't have any military forces of any great strength in Canada. Number two is Mexico. We don't have any forces there. Number three is Venezuela. We don't have any forces there. Number four is Saudi Arabia. We certainly don't have any forces there. As a matter of fact...
Well, I mean, we have had...
We have, but we don't have now.
Well, and we've got 150,000 right next door, not for no reason.
Yes, next door. We're talking about forces inside an oil-exporting country.
So are you suggesting that the concern about a growing militarization of oil supply pipelines and oil fields is just misplaced?
Well, no. The world economy, not just the United States, but the world economy runs on oil. And not all the Saudi oil comes to the United States. As a matter of fact, the amount of oil that we're importing from Saudi Arabia has been declining, and Canada probably supplies us with about 500,000 barrels a day more than does Saudi Arabia. The decline in our imports from Saudi Arabia, though, doesn't mean that the special relationship between our two countries is in any particular danger. I think this shift away from the United States to the market in the Far East, particularly China, is market-driven. There has always been what we call a Far East premium on oil delivered from the Persian Gulf to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about $1.50. In other words,
every
barrel that they deliver to that part of the world, they get $1.50 above the market price. Reverse for the United States, we've been given a break for about 35 cents. A barrel from Saudi Arabia. So, you know, they're taking away our 35 cents and adding it to the $1.50 in China.
And you're talking about just market forces, forces and prices.
Absolutely.
There. Michael Clare, jump in here with us. You describe it rather differently. You describe a kind of inexorable movement toward greater U.S. military deployment to secure oil supplies and a kind of inevitability of military conflict if the U.S. stays in the current path. Robert Ebel says, hey, come on, Canada, Mexico, Venezuela, and on. We're not sending out the military to bring those oil supplies home. Look to the market.
Well, you know, I have great respect for Robert Ebel, and in fact, I rely very much on the study that he authored on energy geopolitics in the 21st century for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And he and his co-authors make two points. One, that more and more of the world's future oil is going to come from the Middle East and Africa because the older fields in the U.S. and Canada, Mexico, are going to produce a declining share of total world output. And secondly, he argues that these petrostates, as he terms them, are inherently unstable. There'll be a high risk of conflict, and that the United States has to be prepared to step in. Maybe I'm not doing total justice to his argument, but that's what I took from it, and that's the basis of my own conclusion.
No, that's fair enough, Michael. And I think we had you, didn't you speak at CSIS some time ago. I thought maybe you did, but that's a fair enough summation, you know, of our position, which was taken 4 years ago and is still, you know, is applicable today.
But that does sound like a roadmap to greater military deployment in oil regions.
You know, and you know, unfortunately, no matter where you seem to look for and find oil today, it's in a generally developing world, inherently unstable world. You go to West Africa, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Russia today, because that's where the reserves are, unfortunately. I wish they were in more stable parts of the world, but they're not. But we learn to live with that, and that's why we have such things as our Strategic Petroleum Reserve, because we know that some point in time, the flow of oil is going to be disrupted. Now, it's not going to be disrupted just to the United States. It's going to impact on the world oil supply as a whole. United States doesn't live in isolation from the oil market. We are vulnerable to any event, anywhere, anytime, and so is any oil importing country, whether it's China or Japan or Germany.
Michael Clare, if I may, I wish you're going to have to sharpen your argument here, because Robert Abel is essentially saying this is all within the realm of what's acceptable. We're going to have to stay on top of it. We have to deal with interruptions sometimes, but this is okay. This is what big boys do. You're saying it's not acceptable. Why?
I believe it's a moral question. Robert Abel and his co-authors in his report say, you quoted him earlier, that America has a special responsibility to protect the world's oil, and that's certainly a realist Washington perspective. I just think that that's unacceptable on moral grounds to the American people, because that means the lives of young men and women in uniform. And we have lost lives in the past few months of young men and women in uniform protecting the oil pipelines and offshore loading facilities in Iraq. And I fear there'll be other losses. And I don't consider that an acceptable moral price to pay.
Do you see Iraq as an oil intervention?
Absolutely. Now, again, this is not simply for the seizure of oil. It's to make the region safe for American access to the oil of Saudi Arabia and the other countries in the surrounding area. So Saddam Hussein did pose a threat to American domination of that region, and the decision was made in Washington to eliminate him through the use of military force. But oil is at the root of our strategic interest in that region.
Robert Abel, do you agree on that front?
Absolutely not. You know, I could buy that agreement, by that argument, if all the oil from Iraq, if all the oil from Saudi Arabia or Kuwait ended up in the United States. But it doesn't. To me, it doesn't make any difference where that oil from Iraq goes, as long as it becomes available to the world oil market. We may never see a drop of it in the United States, because where it goes will be determined by where the oil producers and exporters will get the greatest return on their investment. It probably head to the growth markets in Southeast Asia and the Far East. That's fine. What it does is give the importing countries of the world another choice. And there's no oil importing country that I can think of who doesn't put security of supply at the top of their priority list. We all search for security of supply because our economies are so dependent on a stable, secure, orderly supply of the oil that we need. China today is paranoid about securing security of supply.
I'm not taking full comfort from that security notion. Everybody knows we're dependent on the oil right now, but security seems also to mean that military point that Michael Clare is making. Michael Clare, author of Blood and Oil, is with us. Robert Abel from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We are talking about oil and the U.S. military, how U.S. dependence on foreign oil is driving American military policy. You can join the conversation. What does dependence on foreign oil already mean for the United States? Does it mean we cannot leave Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about oil and the U.S. military. My guests from McLean, Virginia, Robert Abel is with us. He's chairman of the Energy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And from Northampton, Massachusetts, Michael Clare, author of the new book, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency. You can join our conversation. Is there an alternative to defending U.S. access to global oil wells, pipelines, and tanker routes? What does dependence on foreign oil mean long-term for the United States and its military? Is there really an option to GIs guaranteeing the global flow of oil in America? How high will the full price of oil eventually go when you factor in the troops? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Matt is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
My question basically is if the United States was able to transition to some type of alternative fuel, even if it was an eighth or a quarter of our total supply, say to propane or to some form of hydrogen technology within the next 10 years, would that in and of itself cause a destabilization? Because we could prove to the world we don't need you anymore. We have an alternative fuel source that will, for all intents and purposes, never run out if it's hydrogen.
And how do you picture the destabilization that might flow out of that, Matt?
All of the existing countries where their economies are primarily built around petroleum would lose the number one consumer of that product. So if the price of oil starts to creep too high, the alternative energies, once they're developed, as we've seen, such as with microprocessors, once the technology is developed, it's very, very cheap to replicate.
Well, we may be getting way ahead of ourselves, imagining an alternate fuel that could pick up an eighth or something of the economy. But let's pick up the scenario, Matt, and thanks for your call. Michael Clare, paint the picture for us. You want the U.S. to be less dependent on oil. You're saying push hard to alternative fuels. Work that through for us. How soon could the United States achieve a degree of independence from oil dependence that would be significant, and what would the consequences be?
My sense is that this could not happen in the short time span that Matt suggested in his call of 10 years. I think it's going to take longer than that, a quarter of a century or so. So between now and then, that is between now and the time when these alternatives will be really available on a large enough scale to make a difference, I argue we have to be much more prudent in our current use of petroleum, and this mainly because most of our petroleum use is for transportation. We have to be much more fuel efficient. We have to raise the CAFE standards, the corporate fuel efficiency standards, and persuade people with incentives, tax incentives, to trade in their gas guzzlers for hybrids and other fuel-efficient vehicles. We have to stretch out the supply of oil to last until these alternatives come online, and at the same time, this would reduce our dependence on these foreign suppliers. But it's a two-way, it's a two-pronged strategy: conservation now, alternatives down the road.
Robert Ebel, as I read Michael Clare's book, he seems to say, look, we can either go for a kind of Manhattan Project, all-out effort now to get alternative fuels and pour our resources into that, or eventually we will pour our resources in to young American men and women dying for oil around the world. Do you see that formula?
Well, you know, what complicates our analysis of the future is this. It rests in the volatility the price of oil. Oil price is very volatile, and I look at it as economics 101. You know, a rising price contains the seeds of a price decline because it brings new supplies onto the market and it dampens demand. Soon supply begins to outrun demand and prices start to fall. And high cost oil is shut in and demand rises. So it has a particular impact on the development of alternative forms of energy because you know that eventually the price will come down. So you're going to limit your investment in alternative forms of energy, biomass or solar or wind.
But that's until we get on the downside, until we get on the downside of the global oil supply. Once we've passed peak, and some people say we're already there or approaching it, we've got a dwindling supply of oil and increasing demand for oil. Doesn't it change the dynamic?
I don't buy that at all. I just came back from Canada last Friday, and in Canada we have 176 billion barrels of proved reserves of oil sands, and at least that much in the heavy oils in Venezuela. These both fields are price sensitive, but they're bringing them on today because of the of the high price. So I don't buy into the argument that we're cresting the petroleum peak at all. We've been through this argument for the past 50 or 60 years. We're always running out of oil. Jimmy Carter, when he was president, went on the television and said that to the nation that we were going to be running out of oil and natural gas in the next 10 years. Never happened. So it's not the question that we should be addressing. I would agree with Michael that we really need to take a hard look at demand management. But for that demand management to work, there has to be a political will on the part of the consuming public and on the part of our Congress. And we don't have the political will today to make the hard choices, which could very well lead to a change in our lifestyle. And until we get that political will, we're going to go on blankly as we have been.
And with a few soldiers on patrol as well. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got a quick question for Robert. I ended up serving in the Navy for about 4 years, and 3 of those years spent in the Persian Gulf on board destroyers. Robert, those ships burn about 200,000 gallons of fuel every 4 days.
Wow.
And as lieutenants, you know, we always sort of sat around scratching our heads trying to figure out how is this a net good for us that we're burning this much fuel to protect fuel. A carrier battle group has about 7 ships, like I just talked about, and we've had a continuous presence of a carrier battle group in the Gulf since the first Gulf War, so 15 years of it. And it's pretty mind-boggling thinking about how much fuel we are burning every day to stay there.
David, let me ask you, while we've got you, how did you see your presence in the Persian Gulf? You and your colleagues on board, did you think, we're here to protect U.S. oil supplies?
I tell you what, there's actually a patch that we wear when we work for Fifth Fleet out there, and the patch says, protecting American economic prosperity. That's actually on the patch that you wear when you serve in the Fifth Fleet. So it's pretty much in your face from the day that you get there.
It's pretty clear. David, thanks for your call. Robert Ebel.
That, you know, I can see that patch on the uniform of an American soldier, on the uniform of a UN soldier. Might see a patch saying protecting world economic security. But that's what it is. You have to look at it at the world, not just at the U.S. We are a major consumer, of course we are. But I can't think of any country in the world who has a reasonable economy that doesn't depend on a secure, affordable supply of oil.
And that brings us back again to our caller on that ship and a lot of other soldiers around the world. Michael Clare, you bring up two, I guess, principles or guiding stars here that you say the U.S. ought to pay attention to in getting out of a potential future of massive military and present, you might say, deployment around oil. You say autonomy and integrity. We've got a couple of minutes here. Describe what you mean.
Well, by autonomy, I mean giving ourselves freedom of action. By that, I mean eliminating a situation where we feel so dependent on Saudi Arabia that we'll do anything to keep the Saudi royal power, the royal family in power indefinitely. We feel trapped in that alliance, that embrace, as I call it. We need to be free from those kinds of perceived obligations so that we don't have to prop up dictators around the world.
And integrity?
And integrity is truthfulness and recognizing that in the future oil is going to run out and we should have the interests of the next generations in mind too. And not to burn up all the oil right away, but to plan an orderly transition for the next generation to a post-petroleum economy that's environmentally safe.
But Robert Ebel points out, as do you, that may require real lifestyle changes for Americans. Any chance of a president taking that on?
Both presidential candidates this year acknowledge the necessity of making this change in the future. If you listen to them carefully, they both recognize that for environmental and other reasons, we have to make this dramatic transition. They just want to postpone it to the future so that the burden falls on our children and grandchildren. And that's what I find unethical. And when I say integrity, I'm saying we should bear some of that burden now.
And what's your guess on the price the U.S. military will pay to protect U.S. oil intake in the decades ahead?
In the hundreds of billions of dollars.
and that's not to mention the lives. Michael Clare, thanks so much for the book and the perspectives. Really an interesting read. Blood and Oil is the book. Michael Clare, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Robert Ebel, chairman of the Energy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a first-hand look at the lives of the displaced residents of Darfur, Sudan. This is On Point. In a rare interview today, Sudan's security chief told Reuters that rebels have been using villages in Darfur as bases for military operations. Attacks on villages by government planes and soldiers have driven 1.5 million Darfur residents from their homes, but there's the claim. Krista Ridley is deputy director of policy for Oxfam America. She recently returned from a trip to Darfur. In this radio diary, she describes what she saw when she visited the makeshift refugee camps that are serving as homes to displaced residents of Darfur.
One of the villages I was in was Kass. It's actually a town, and the town has been basically overtaken by people who have been displaced. So it was a mixture of schools and small tents and things that the displaced were staying in. So they were staying in schools, and they had to move out of the schools in many cases because they wanted to start school for the children who weren't displaced. You saw little haphazardly organized shelters that people had created with sticks and plastic bags and some plastic sheeting that relief agencies had given them, but really sparsely decorated or, you know, with very little possessions because most people ran away and they weren't able to bring much of anything with them. The discussions I had with the displaced people in the camps, they basically said there was shooting, there were people coming after them, there was attacks, people on camels, people on horses, and some of their homes were burned down, and they were forced to flee without time to pack bags or anything like that. And many of them walked for days before they got to a place where they could seek safety. The places where they sought safety, basically camps grew up there. And so they were not planned in advance, so they're very haphazardly organized, which makes it a little bit more difficult for the relief agencies to service them. I think I saw a woman sitting under a shade, and she had just had a baby recently, and she was with another group of women, and it just made me think that despite the misery of their condition, life goes on. People have babies, children go to school in the camps, children play and run around, and things continue despite the difficult existence that they're experiencing. And I find a resilience amongst these people, an ability to transcend their situation. The other thing that I notice always, and I've had experience living in Africa, is the hospitality and the kindness that you're shown. People who have virtually nothing will offer you to share with you a drink of tea, for example. They'll bring out the best piece of furniture that they have for you to sit on, and they'll sit on the dirt. Despite their situation, once again, their culture remains, their culture of hospitality and care for a visitor, and their lives continue. Well, I think the numbers alone are compelling. We're talking 1.2 million displaced people, 2 million people affected by the crisis, people whose homes have been burned, who've lost everything they own, who are living in miserable camp situation all over Darfur. So kind of painting a picture of how people are living and then painting a picture of what international community and organizations are doing to try to help those people. And just a sense of this is not only the problem of Sudan, this is the problem of the world, and the world community needs to step forward and do something about it. And we're all connected. And an interesting story, we were talking to a woman who received a non-food item distribution, which she got a bucket and a basin and soap and everything. And she said, "Thank you so much to Oxfam. We really appreciate what you've done for us." And our staff person said, "Well, I hope that you would do the same for me if I was in that situation." And the woman said she surely would. She would be the first one in line to help us if the same thing was happening to us. And that just made me think that's the heart of it. It's all our connectedness as a world community.
Krista Ridley is Deputy Director of Policy for Oxfam America. She returned this month from a field visit to the Darfur region of Sudan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.